From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Egypt's Arab Spring is in deep trouble. Egyptians voted for president this weekend, a runoff between a candidate from the Muslim Brotherhood and the former prime minister of ousted dictator Hosni Mubarak. The Muslim Brotherhood is claiming victory in Cairo this morning, but Egypt's military has stepped in hard in the last few days. The army, the secret police, the deep state reasserting control. This hour On Point, the Arab Spring's future in Egypt. You can join the conversation. Are we seeing a democratic vote for president and a coup, a counter-revolution, all at the same time in Egypt? What is happening to Egypt's Arab Spring? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood campaign, coordinator Ahmed Abdel Atti, declaring victory for his candidate today. In Arabic there, saying Mohamed Morsi has won the majority of ballots in the two-day runoff election over the weekend. But there is a lot more going on than that. First to Cairo today, where I'm joined by Nancy Youssef, Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. She's been right there in the thick of things in Egypt. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be back.
And along with Nancy in Cairo from Washington, we're joined by Samer Shahada. He's Assistant Professor of Arab Politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University. Born in Egypt, was there for the first round of presidential voting at the end of May. Samer Shahada, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy, what's the latest here? We know the Muslim Brotherhood has declared victory for their candidate, and I guess the Egyptian news media is now saying the same?
That's right. It appears this is all based on the vote count that happens after the election by the delegates, and there seems to be a consensus that Mohamed Morsi won 51% of the vote to 51.8, I believe, to Ahmed Shafiq, nearly 49%. And so the news seems to be settling in. We also heard from staff today for the first time, and they really tried to make their case for why they had done what they had done and refuted claims that they were going for a power grab, that they were doing what they saw was in the best interest of Egypt, and that they were trying to balance the power of the government and step in the absence of a legitimate parliament.
You're talking about military staff there. Now, formal results from this election, here are projections, but the formal results don't come out until later in the week. We've seen the military with so many dramatic moves this week, and the vote counting, I guess, isn't formally finished. So could we still have a victory declared at some point by the last prime minister for Hosni Mubarak, Ahmed Shafiq?
We could. I mean, this is Egypt, and so nothing is ever predictable. But I think one of the reasons people are accepting the results here is because during the first round of elections, the Muslim Brotherhood put out its numbers, and it seemed to be accurate. And while Ahmed Shafiq has come out today and said he disputes the findings, there seems to be a pretty wide consensus that this is probably the outcome. But again, nothing here is predictable. The margin is so close between the two candidates that it's certainly possible. But as of now, people are accepting that Morsi won.
Such a dramatic few days leading up to and during the course of this two-day runoff vote, Nancy. I mean, the deal was the military was supposed to hand off to civilian government, but they say they're kind of doing that, but they've kept all these powers for themselves now, right?
That's right.
Legislation, for budgeting, for defining the power of the presidency itself.
That's right, and it started Wednesday with the military declaring essentially the reinstatement of martial law. This is just weeks after the three-decade-long emergency law had expired. The following day, the Supreme Constitutional Court essentially declared that one-third of the parliament was illegal and therefore parliament must be dissolved. Remember, parliament was the first democratically elected body here since Mubarak's fall. And then, within minutes of the polls closing last night, the military released amendments to the Constitution spelling out what the president's responsibilities would be. Remember, voters went to the polls having no idea what powers the president would have. And among the things that SCAF said in this new constitution, this new temporary constitution, was that before the president could go to war, he would have to consult SCAF, that SCAF would be at the center of every major decision. So in the span of a few days, the military took control of the legislative, parts of the executive, and in part, through a judiciary court appointed by Mubarak.
You talk about SCAF. You mean by that that's an acronym for the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces.
Right.
Samer Shahada, you've described this as the deep state in Egypt. It was supposed to cede power. What happened?
Well, of course, the SCAF was never interested in the revolution or in democratization in Egypt. They threw Mr. Mubarak under the bus at the 11th hour on February 10th or the 11th in order to save themselves. And, of course, they were very much a part of the regime, a core element of the regime, along with the Ministry of the Interior, the intelligence agencies, and so on. And they have very real interests, not only economic interests, but political and personal interests. They were part of this criminal regime for 30 plus years, and they want to safeguard their own interests. They don't want to end up in a cage like Mr. Mubarak or on trial. And they also want to ensure some autonomy. So one of the interesting aspects of the SCAF declaration, the completion to the interim constitution, was that the SCAF, the military, will run all affairs of the military. The president will have no say in appointments or any kind of changes with regard to the military until things settle and the new constitution is written and a parliament is elected and so on. And so there are very serious interests at stake here.
Maybe we can say military instead of SCAF. SCAF is kind of confusing. A lot of anger about all this in Egypt. Here of thousands of angry demonstrators. This was on Thursday, just after the court ruling that led to the dissolution of the newly elected parliament. Egyptian critics calling it a coup d'etat, even a counter-revolution. Nancy, what on earth is the feeling in the streets there with all of these heavy crosswinds?
It's utter confusion, really. You talk to people and they're frustrated, they're angry. Some people said that they thought their vote wasn't going to count on Election Day. Some people are quite thrilled because they think that with Morsi winning, that someone who's guided by Islam will lead the state and that will prove the country's economic problems and its security problems. It's really a state of confusion at this point, because every day there's a sort of dramatic turn. Remember the ruling military council, mm-hmm. which has been ruling the country since Mubarak's resignation, kind of operates secretly and through whispers and then these sudden pronouncements. And so if you're an Egyptian voter, I think there was a lot of confusion about how you vote. I think each Egyptian has become his own strategist in the absence of sort of a revolutionary one. And so I don't know how to describe it other than just an utter state of confusion. And I would also say in some cases fear that there was not a revolution at all, that the regime is still very much intact.
Confusion, coup, talk of counter-revolution. Here's a professor, Khaled Afami, the American University in Cairo, talking with Al Jazeera just hours after the court's ruling dissolving parliament on Thursday.
I actually think it is a legal coup, a legal coup in the sense that it's not legitimate, obviously, but it's a coup through courts, through judges, through the law. This is a coup that reflects the tug of war between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Samer Shahada, what about this framing? Is it appropriate, to, despite what the military is saying today, to look at this as a counter-revolution, a coup, a revolution that never really happened?
Well, that's correct. And this is, you know, what we have been saying, that in fact what the protesters in Tahrir and squares across the country managed to do during those 18 days was unseat Mr. Mubarak, but not effect significant change in the state, in the regime, in the institutions of power that had been in place for 30-some years and had been set up as an autocratic, corrupt system. And this extends to, for example, many of the individuals who are judges on the Supreme Constitutional Court. It extends to many of those who lead very important state institutions, the equivalent of the Office of Management and Budget in Egypt, not to mention all of the intelligence agencies and so on. They, acceded to the protesters' desire to remove Mubarak, but they certainly were not interested in the deep structural change that Egyptians wanted with regard to setting up a democratic state with transparency, with participation, with oversight, with civilian control of the military. So from the, February 11th until the present, we have been seeing major struggles that we can see in front of the curtain and struggles behind the curtain. And the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is the main, one of the main non-military players, but there are others as well. And sometimes their interests overlap and sometimes their interests don't overlap. For much of the last 15, 16 months, the Muslim Brotherhood has accommodated the military in hopes that if the process goes the way it's supposed to and elections are free and fair and so on, they're going to find a place at the table. Over the last month or so, when they tried to pass legislation, withdraw confidence from the military-appointed cabinet, and the military refused, tensions escalated, and there was a kind of confrontation between the Muslim Brotherhood, its Freedom and Justice Party, and the military.
We'll come back and look at this, but I mean, Nancy, in Egypt, are people looking at their great Arab Spring, which the whole world watched with such amazement? Was it a farce?
I think the revolutionaries are feeling that way. The interesting thing is there is no one Egyptian voice here. You can find the whole spectrum of emotions here. There are some people who are quite thrilled, but I think for the revolutionaries in particular, the people who took to the streets, who risked their lives, who really wanted major reforms here, I think they feel that they were not very smart in how they approached the period after Mubarak resigned. And there's a lot of blaming going on within that movement.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound behind us there from February 11th, just last year. Vast, euphoric crowd gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square, celebrating the news then that Hosni Mubarak, the longtime dictator, had resigned from Egypt's presidency after 2 weeks of anti-regime demonstrations. It was a night of euphoria. Here we are, these months later, looking at elections and turmoil and the military stepping back in hard in Egypt. We're asking what's happened to Egypt's Arab Spring. Nancy Youssef is with us. Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers joins us from Cairo. Samer Shahada joins us, Assistant Professor Arab Politics at Georgetown University, author of Islamist Politics in the Middle East. He was born in Alexandria, Egypt, and been in the U.S. for a long time. He was back there for the first round of voting in the presidential vote. Let's get our listeners in. Phoebe in Charlottesville, Virginia. Phoebe, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Youssef and Shahada. I'm sorry if I butchered y'all's names. My comment slash question is, from what we saw last year, there was a great force of social media involved in, I guess, the people being heard and then listened to in seeing Mubarak. And just listening to what you all have been talking about, there's a lot of confusion. There's, you know, military trying to hang on to the power that they had in getting rid of the figurehead, but still remaining. So I just want to know if there is any kind of back and forth going on between, you know, the Brotherhood.
Muslim Brotherhood.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And everybody else, because that seemed to be, at least as I understood it, the role in which the media, social media, played in unseating and really starting this revolution and keeping it from, or would keep it from being a rebellion, essentially, just, you know, a transition of an autocratic government.
Exactly. So, transition was the word, and there was so much pride in the fact that despite the violence that was there, it wasn't really so much on the revolution's side, that it looked like a peaceful path. Phoebe, I appreciate that. Nancy, take us back here, because this is exactly where a lot of Americans, I think, last paid close attention. Those vast crowds were there. We all were hearing about these young, secular reformers, revolutionaries with their Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts and this amazing thing that happened and a kind of joining forces at that time of Muslim Brotherhood and those calling for this big transition in the streets. Take us there. What's happened to the people who filled Tahrir Square, and what about that apparent kind of alliance at that time between the secular people there and the Muslim Brotherhood there, Nancy?
Well, frankly, I think it was a marriage of convenience, because what the Brotherhood has done successfully, remember, it's the largest political organization in Egypt. It's the most well-organized. It can get people out on the street like no other group can in this country. And I think what we've seen over the last year is that the Brotherhood really oscillated between going back to the state, if you will, when it needed it, and going to the revolutionaries when it needed them. So they weren't really revolutionaries. They were sort of reformers. And frankly, their participation in the election, the revolutionaries would say, was just further proof of that. That is, they trusted the system, whereas the revolutionaries would say it's the system that's corrupt and we can't legitimize it by participating. Now, that said, there's a case to be made that the Brotherhood will need the revolutionaries and the public writ large now more than ever, because if the results stick, there's no mandate for them. The country's split along those who think there have been enough change, who think that the state is better in the hands of someone who understands it, and those who think the Brotherhood should do it. So I don't think the Brotherhood have the option of sort of dismissing the secularists or dismissing a large segment of this population, because if the results hold, they barely won, and they need a Band-Aid to help lead Egypt through what's a very unstable time.
Summer, I was talking with an Egyptian who was in the U.S. over the weekend, a secularist, I would say, saying that the choices that he saw in the weekend's presidential voting were the worst of all the earlier dozen or more options that were there. Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, or former Prime Minister, the last Prime Minister, to Mubarak on the other. What about secularists in the secularist revolutionaries, if we can call them that, in Egypt now, Samer, including those who were tweeting and up on Facebook and all the rest? Where's their energy? Where are they?
Well, they certainly weren't represented on the ballot that Egyptians just voted on. And in fact, there were a few in the runoff. There were a few individuals who were clearly liberal, if not secular-minded candidates in the first round. And a couple of them did fairly well, in fact. One of them did fairly well. But I think one of the problems, one of the kind of deep fissures in Egyptian society, is that the so-called liberals, and let's call them liberals now, not secularists, mm-hmm. because they still believe that Islam should play a role in society somehow, not that it should govern politics, but they're not fully secular in the understanding maybe that many people have, mm-hmm. that they are really committed to liberalism and human rights and so on, as long as the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't win in elections. And similarly, the Muslim Brotherhood, in other words, so they're liberals without being Democrats. And similarly, the Muslim Brotherhood and members of the organization are Democrats. They believe in elections and the ballot box and so on. I think they have a clear record of that for 35 years or so, participating in fraudulent elections under Mubarak at the national level and all kinds of syndicates and so on. At the same time, they're not liberals. So we have mm-hmm. meaning that they don't believe in full equality for all Egyptians, for women, for Christian Egyptians, for minorities, and so on. And what happens, unfortunately, is we get a situation in which liberals sometimes, supposed liberals, sometimes are willing to support the Egyptian military, for example, or support Mr. Mubarak or Mr. Mubarak's cronies, because they fear the Muslim Brotherhood more than they love democracy. Mm-hmm. And this is a tragic state. And this is not in any way to justify the Muslim Brotherhood's record over the last 16 months. In fact, it's been quite abysmal. The Muslim Brotherhood arrived late to the revolution, and they left early and abandoned the protesters in Tahrir Square and really did not speak out forcefully against the trials of civilians in military courts, the excessive use of force to the point of easily 200 deaths since the revolution, security forces using force against civilian mm-hmm. protesters and mm-hmm. so on. So we have this deep split in Egyptian political society. And I think, like Nancy, hopefully the Muslim Brotherhood will have gotten the message that although Mohamed Morsi won barely, they will need to work with many segments in Egyptian society in order to kind of move forward and hopefully remove the biggest obstacle to genuine democracy in Egypt, which is the deep state, the military, the Ministry of Interior, which was the repressive boot of the Mubarak regime mm-hmm. against the neck of the Egyptian people, the intelligence agencies, and so on. I hope that's the case.
I want to look more at that deep state, what constitutes it. But Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Stephen is calling. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Well, with the, I guess the point that I'm going to make is just to have faith in the Egyptian people, because if the military does try to have a strong and lasting grab for power, I think we're going to see just a second revolution similar to what brought Mubarak down. It seems like the people in Egypt are really striving to finally have a government where they can, you know, elect and have a say in who's there. And if it's not that way, they're going to rise up, they're going to protest against it. So, I mean, if the military does try to essentially have a coup and take over the government, I think the Egyptian people are going to rebound and try it all over again.
Stephen, I appreciate your call. Nancy Youssef, how does that strike your ear in Cairo, in Egypt, in the midst of all this? Do you share Stephen's confidence?
Well, I do, in the sense that I think the military is aware of this. And remember, they came forth today and made a very legal argument. That is, they are presenting what they think the law is and how it should be interpreted. Their argument is that they're not attempting a coup, that they are really trying to protect the state, that they, you know, there's this attitude that they essentially know best and they're trying to protect the state. It's an interesting point that Stephen raises, because not just pertaining to the military, but to even to the Brotherhood and to Shafiq, there's a very profound feeling here that if officials don't respond the way that people want, that they have the square. That said, I think the fact that the military council was able to employ the law to put in reforms as they see it, or changes, or whatever, or a coup d'etat, whatever you want to call it, has some people a little dispirited, that maybe the square is not enough. And so there's sort of a reexamination of the value of the square going on right now in Egypt. Remember when Mubarak was found guilty and given a life sentence, and his subordinates were exonerated in the trial, the square filled up. And a week later, when the constitutional court rules that the parliament must be dissolved, the parliament they voted for, the square was relatively empty. There's a new way people are looking at the square, and I think people are really asking, is the square enough to bring about change?
The square is a kind of symbol for public demonstrations and protests that could steer the ship there. What do you make, Samra Shahada, of the military's legal argument saying this is not a coup, this is not a counter-revolution, they're saying, you know, very legalistically, no, we're just trying to keep some stability here and defend the state?
No, I think that any serious observer of what the military and really people now are differentiating between those 22 or 18, we don't even know, military officers who are running the show, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, mm-hmm. and the military as an institution, despising one and having some regard for the military as an institution. Okay. I think they have very little credibility at this point. And the legal arguments that are, and it's also important to be said, as you and Nancy have mentioned, that the Supreme Constitutional Court, many of the individuals in the Supreme Constitutional Court, including the head and the deputy head, are Mubarak appointees. And if they are not beholden to the military, they certainly despise the Muslim Brotherhood and see it as counter to the idea of a modern state and so on, and feel threatened by the Islamists generally. So this is what I was saying before, mm-hmm. about the deep division in Egypt between liberals and Islamists. However, at the same, and I think that Nancy is correct, there are limitations to what massive protests in Tahrir and other squares can do. And one of the problems that the revolutionaries faced, as well as liberals generally, is an inability to organize coherent political parties, reach out to people, not just on television and through ads, but in their communities, and make a case that they should vote for them in the parliamentary elections or in the presidential elections. This kind of connection with the population is something that is missing, and the close proximity of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists to the population, to people in the street, in the neighborhoods, whether it's through social service provision or others, is there. And that's quite important. At the same time, this circle can be squared, or the square can be circled in a way. We know what, to some extent, we know what the military wants. And through some kind of a negotiation, a safe exit, as it were, some kind of passage so that they don't end up on trial like Mr. Mubarak, so that they have some control over military affairs, so that in a transition period, a military man remains the Minister of Defense and it isn't a civilian and so on. Some kind of autonomy, unfortunately, and lack of transparency with regard to military budgets. Now, this isn't perfect, but we know what the interests of part of the deep state is, and through some kind of negotiation, and of course, these types of negotiations were taking place over the last 16 months between the Muslim Brotherhood leaders and others and members of the armed forces. So I think that's likely to continue in the next period.
Though it doesn't look much like it's worked very well so far. We're looking at elections and turmoil and charges of coup in Egypt. Let me bring one more Cairo voice in here. Hossam Bagat joins us, human rights lawyer, activist with the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, joins us from Cairo. Mr. Bagat, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You've said that the new constitutional declaration has completed Egypt's official transformation into a military dictatorship. Have we seen a coup?
We've seen the completion of a coup. Effectively, what happened last night was really declaring any transfer of power to a civilian government, as promised by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, completely meaningless. The military have leadership have effectively established complete autonomy from the state, turned the new president, whoever he might be, into a figurehead who has no say on anything related to the armed forces, its budget, or appointing or relieving their commanders, and wrote into the constitution a complete militarization of law enforcement, including the right to write their own rules on the use of force, arrest and detention and trial of civilians, as well as rules on criminal liability for the personnel of the armed forces as they conduct domestic law enforcement, which is the most explicit reference to impunity, of course, for the armed forces from any future accountability for crimes and violations that have been committed since they came to power in February of last year.
They
are on the street.
With all of that, was the Arab Spring in Egypt a mirage somehow?
The Arab Spring was a narrative. Of course, we felt it, and we felt it genuinely. We were on the streets. We faced, bullets and brutality.
It's amazing.
Of the Mubarak regime, what we're coming to realize right now is that these mesmerizing days and protests for the whole world created a path for the military leadership to push away their commander-in-chief. But since then, they have been hard at work preserving their interests, protecting themselves from any future accountability, and sealing off the entire political system in Egypt, establishing effective control not just on the so-called transition, but also on the future, because now what the military wrote into this new constitutional declaration is that they are going to select every one of the 100 members that are going to write the new constitution, and they will still have the right to veto any provision that is written into the new permanent constitution before it is put to a public referendum.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about elections, turmoil, and the military stepping in hard in Egypt. And what's happening to Egypt's Arab Spring? Here's sound from last night in Cairo. Hundreds of supporters of Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi, who has now said he has won the runoff presidential election this weekend. Supporters flooded into Tahrir Square, burning photos of the ousted dictator, Hosni Mubarak, and chanting, "Down with military dictatorship." They can chant, but the military council, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, is very much in charge right now in Egypt and taken dramatic steps in the last few days to make it more so. At the same time, The Muslim Brotherhood candidate has won, we're told, the popular vote, though the formal count on that we won't know until the end of the week. Nancy Youssef is McClatchy Newspaper's Middle East Bureau Chief and joins us from Cairo. She's with us there in Egypt today. Hossam Bagat is with us, human rights lawyer and activist there with the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. Activist and human rights lawyer there, Samer Shahada, is with us from the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies at Georgetown University, joins us today from Washington. Let's get a call from Montreal, Canada. Teddy, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Firstly, unlike Turkey, Egypt doesn't have a moderate Islamist party to rein in the military. And secondly, I think we tend to forget that the generals have always been a key in providing political and economic stability in Egypt. And I think we shouldn't discount that. And we should also keep in mind that since Nasser up to Sadat, particularly Anwar Sadat, it was his leadership and charisma that led to the peace treaty with Israel. And I think that was essentially a milestone in providing peace in the region.
So are you saying maybe it's not so bad that the military is still fundamentally in charge? Is that your view, Teddy?
Well, you know, I tend to be a kind of geopolitical fellow in the sense that I don't think it's wise to demonize the military. What is the alternative? A radical Islamic government which would perhaps lash out at its neighbors, in particular Israel. That's not, I think, a viable option. And if the military provides stability with all the nastiness that might be associated with, I think that's possibly better than having a chaotic situation which exists right now.
Teddy, let us pick it up. Of course, it's nice when you're in Montreal and not living the nastiness. But Hossam Bagat, what do you say to that perspective from Montreal?
I think what we're seeing right now is really, the preconditions of more instability. There is just no way that that I can imagine, stability on the short term. The military, by turning the president into a figurehead, are preparing for the next crisis. And the next crisis could be so many things. It could be, a group of protesters on Tahrir Square in a week or a month or in a couple of months, and then the new president is going to be either ordering the security forces to brutally crack down on that process or failing to rein in the security forces after they brutally crack down on these protesters. Eventually, there are going to be people on the street calling on an now delegitimized the president to resign, calling him a puppet of the military, or openly protesting against the continuation of military dictatorship, albeit behind a facade of an elected president. In all cases, I think we're going to be heading to another political impasse. The new president is going to be delegitimized sooner rather than later, effectively, there is going to be an open confrontation again between, the angry young revolutionaries that, had revolted against Mubarak and are prepared to revolt again against Mubarak's, military leaders. And the question then is going to be whether a President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood are going to be on the side of these revolutionaries or on the side of the brutal state dictatorship. But in both cases, we're looking at trouble. The only way out of this is to declare the end and the death of this so-called transition, which has been merely theatrics, by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and to start a new course where the military's role is confined to guarding the borders of the country where the military are not exercising any control over the composition of the body that will write the constitution, the content of the new constitution, or any executive powers over a democratically elected president or institutions. Without starting a new course towards democratic transition, we're going to be inside this dark tunnel for a long time to come.
Stand by there, Hossam. Nancy Youssef, can you see, can you imagine, assuming it is Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate who has won the presidency, could you see the Muslim Brotherhood and the military council working together, even though they broke so dramatically last week with the military's intervention in Parliament? Could you imagine a kind of alliance here, or is that beyond imagining, Nancy?
I don't right now, because as it is, the Muslim Brotherhood has called the temporary constitution invalid, so that fight's already begun. They've already said that the Parliament still exists despite the military thing that's dissolved, so that fight's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a long-standing history of friction between the SCAF and the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I could see deals being struck between each party to take care of interests. But in terms of working together, it doesn't seem possible. That said, the reality is SCAF, if Morsi's inaugurated, will have to salute him as their civilian commander-in-chief. So who knows how that's going to change things and how that's going to change the dynamic in terms of how each group sees one another. But the history up until now, and even in the last 24 hours, suggests a series of battles ahead rather than reconciliation.
If they salute, I mean, with everything that's going on, that would presumably look like a joke salute. Samer, you talk about the possibility maybe of a safe exit for those in that deep state who need to have a path described where they could get out, you know, with their hide intact here somehow. But is that really possible? I mean, this deep state and the military also are so deep in the Egyptian economy. Don't they own, in effect, huge portions of it? How do you disentangle that?
Well, that's correct. And you know, certainly, ideally, of course, the military from tomorrow would only do the things that Hossam has mentioned. And I think many of us feel that is the proper role of the military. As Mohammed al-Baradei and many others have said, there's no reason that the military should produce macaroni, which is what the Egyptian military does, in addition to
every other industry
you can think of, and so on. And of course, we don't know what the spreadsheets and the budgets of these things are. But realistically, in terms of where power is located now, that's not going to take place tomorrow. And it's going to take place through either negotiation or crisis, or pressure, sustained pressure on the military. And I would hope, I don't think this is necessarily naive, that the military sees the direction things are going, realizes that we are in 2012 and not 1965, and can realize that they are not going to be controlling Egypt in the way that Mr. Mubarak, Mr. Sadat, Mr. Gamal Abdel Nasser did for the last 50 or 60 years. And I think there are many people in Egypt who are willing to, in a transitional way, give some of them some kind of safe exit and give them, in the interim, some kind of assurances about the military and the autonomy having to do with military decisions and so on,
mm-hmm.
in the hopes that we can move over a longer period to a deepening of democratization. Now, that won't necessarily be justice,
mm-hmm.
because as I've mentioned, there have been at least 200 people who have been killed as a result of the excessive use of force against civilian protesters since Mr. Mubarak left office until the present, and the military is responsible for that. That won't be justice, but it'll be a way out of this crisis.
If there's enough leverage even for some way out. Passant in Arlington, Massachusetts. Passant, thanks. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hello.
I just wanted to comment that there are a lot of people that did vote for Mohamed Morsi, who is the Muslim Brotherhood candidate.
Yes.
No, not because they believe in their policies or they believe in their ideas. It's just that they kind of want to escape from Mubarak's regime. They found that they have no other way to make Shafi kind of fail and not being the president of Egypt, other just that by the way, that they have to vote for Mohamed Morsi.
Hassan, are you Egyptian? Did you vote?
No,
yes, I did vote, and I'm Egyptian. My first vote wasn't for Mohamed Morsi.
Yes.
I don't believe in the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, mm-hmm. but what I'm saying is that there are a lot of people that did vote against Jaffe, and that's how they were thinking, and they were not voting for the Muslim Brotherhood.
When their only option was to vote for the former Mubarak man, they went for the Muslim Brotherhood man, and we see how that's apparently turning out in Egypt. Hassan, we'll pick that up, and I appreciate your call there. Hassan Bagat in Cairo, what about our caller's point there? She voted for Morsi with the Muslim Brotherhood because she didn't see any other choice, finally this weekend, to push back on the Mubarak regime. Could you see the Muslim Brotherhood effectively somehow pushing them out or giving them a path out of power, Hossam?
No, I mean, in fact, the election of Morsi was the choice of many people, obviously, that supported the revolution and that wanted to at least make a dent at the you know shield of power enjoyed by not just the military in Egypt but the entire you know deep state, the intelligence industry, the security apparatus, and the military and its intelligence, of course. Mm-hmm. That you know. Those people would have been celebrating today the expected or apparent win of President Morsi. Unfortunately, you know, a few minutes after the polls closed, while people were still starting to count, it was 10 p.m. last night on a national holiday for the elections the military leaders decided to make the entire process meaningless. It doesn't matter today who is elected president, whether it's Morsi or Shafiq, because the actual president in Egypt, as many are saying today on social media, is Tantawi, is the head of SCAF. The new interim constitution issued last night forbids the newly elected president from even changing the current composition of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces.
Right.
Today, this morning, in the press conference held by the military council, they said, fine, we might allow the new president to appoint his own minister of defense, mm-hmm. but Tantawi still remains the president of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. So even, you know, the general commander of the army is not going to be able to be unseated, if you want, from the military council by the commander-in-chief. So
that pretty much tells you who's in charge right there, doesn't it? I mean, it couldn't be clearer than that if that's what's going on. Joe in Marfa, Texas. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Say, my mind goes to what America's role is in this. I don't think that we fought 10 years of war and have had a former ally in Egypt that signed a peace treaty with Israel just to handed over the government to the Islamic Brotherhood. So I'm wondering, you know, 2012 or not, the Western powers don't want to see that to happen. I mean, that would forget Syria, which Russia is blocking and will never step into. As soon as this happened, I can't believe that America did not know what the military there would do. So my question is, are we going to cut defense spending for them, for their army? And what does everybody think about that?
Yeah, great question, Joe. Let us pick it up right there. Billions to Egypt. What about it, Samir Shahada? A U.S. wink and a nod to the military here and these moves it's taken in recent days? Does Washington have that kind of relationship with the deep state in Egypt? What do you say?
Well, I think there's no question that, you know, for 30-plus years, the United States was a primary supporter of Mr. Mubarak and specifically the military. And in fact, in the days and weeks after the revolution, quote unquote, the American officials looked at the Egyptian political scene and they saw only one institution that they felt they could do business with and that they had serious connections with, and that was the military. That being said, however, I think that there's no question that over the last 10, 12, 15 months, the United States has realized that things are changing, that Islamists are very powerful. A number of high-ranking American officials, including Senator Kerry, as well as Assistant Secretary of State Burns, and others at Lindsey Graham have gone, visited members of the Muslim Brotherhood, including Mohamed Morsi, and have accommodated themselves to the idea that there's going to be change. And at the same time, and this gets to something else your caller said, the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't in the short term or even in the medium term necessarily threaten some of the interests that the United States extracts from Egypt, the specific interests that the United States extracts from Egypt regarding to the maintenance of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. Mm-hmm. The Muslim Brotherhood is not interested in tearing that up. Regarding to other aspects having to do with overflight rights, having to do with passage of U.S. vessels through the Suez Canal, military cooperation, and so on. So the threat to American interests that potentially the Muslim Brotherhood or any really popularly elected Egyptian government would pose isn't as great as many believe.
Well, in this set of days, we're thinking about Egyptian interests and everything they fought so hard and publicly and gallantly for just February of last year, and now so much on the line there in Egypt. Just an incredible story. We will continue to watch it here stateside. Nancy Youssef with McClatchy Newspapers, Middle East Bureau Chief, joining us there today from Cairo. Thank you so much for your reporting and your insights today, Nancy. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Hossam Bagat with the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, activist, human rights lawyer there in Cairo. Thank you, Mr. Bagat.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Good luck to you. And Samer Shahada at Georgetown University, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.